Good afternoon and welcome everyone to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, March 17th, 2007. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm with the economic section of the Executive Intelligence Review News Service. And as I said, March 17th, today, St. Patrick's Day, we are all engaged in wearing of the green, and we're definitely engaged in ending the crazy green kind of thinking that we've been seeing from Al Gore and the financial interests behind him to divert everyone from real crises that are taking place in the world, not the meltdown of the planet, but in fact the meltdown of the financial system. And this brings us to the topic of our discussion today. We're going to discuss one particular aspect of that that's in play right now, the bad loans in the home mortgage market known as the subprime sector, that is, loans that in the first place shouldn't have probably taken place but amount to multi-billions of dollars. We're going to talk about the whole systemic, the nature of the financial meltdown, and we are doing that in a context of, we know, strategic dangers in the world, potential war threats on Iran and elsewhere from the Bush-Cheney regime still in office. We can get to the strategic situation. That's what the whole financial meltdown is about. So I welcome to our show two people today. One thing is I have here in the studio with me Richard Freeman. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm going to say, Richard, that we're especially glad to have you. People should know Richard is in the throes of writing up the latest situation he's going to discuss in this financial meltdown, which will be posted on our LaRouchePub.com site within a few days and will be a feature of the next printed magazine. And we're going to get into the dimensions, the whole nine yards of this in just a minute. But we have from the LaRouche Youth Movement, we're very glad to have Lewis Wilden out in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Lewis.
How you doing?
Very good. And I just want to say one thing about that, Lewis. Since I was monitoring the kind of television business shows this morning to see how much they are or ain't saying about this crisis situation, Lewis is speaking to us from one of the two cities listed as the worst cities for home mortgage foreclosures, Atlanta, Georgia, and Detroit. Now, MSNBC could be lying. We know that happens. And they're having a lot of spin. But this whole situation is really extreme, and Mr. LaRouche has been warning about it, not just in general over the years and over the last few months, but specifically, Richard may get into that, has been indicating the timing of how this impossible bubble was going to be bursting. And the way we're going to do the show, and we entertain you sending in your emails, you know it's at radio@larouchepub.com, those of you who are listening that way, and some of you who are listening in groups, feel free for Richard and Lewis, and those of you know it's larouchepub.com, radio@larouchepub.com. What we were going to do is have Lewis start off with a bit of an empirical firsthand from ground zero kickoff of just what the situation is in Detroit. The LaRouche Youth Movement has been all over the place. They've been to Lansing. They've been to the state capitol. They've been to – but what's it look like, Lewis?
Well, here in Detroit, you have certain – well, I mean, I'll just say this. There's really no illusions about the question of the economic financial collapse in the country. That's for sure. You almost tell people on the phone, well, you don't believe it? You're denying this? Step outside your porch and look around. Okay, now this is what we're going to do, right? Because it's a pretty destroyed city. It's what happens when you kind of take away from a city its reason for existence, and that's the destruction of the auto sector. And, you know, we've done a lot of lobbying and a lot of work around that and deploying to the auto plants and things of that nature, introducing LaRouche's solution to that, the retooling of the auto sector. You know, just in general, you know, it's in the city itself, you have skyscrapers that are boarded up or skyscrapers in which only the bottom floors are being used, et cetera, right? And in terms of the question of the housing market, we had did a walking tour in Dearborn, Michigan, because we did a town hall meeting shortly ago on the question of double impeachment and the financial collapse. And so we went door to door to organize this town hall meeting, which we brought about 25 new people from this kind of door-to-door organizing. But what was wild was that for every block that we walked, there were three or four pink or yellow slips, you know, put on the front doors of these houses, essentially announcing that this house has been foreclosed on by the banks. And in my own neighborhood here in Redford, which is a little outside Detroit, there's about three in the various streets, all of which were occupied last year, at least. And we had also saw things along the lines of, you know, someone who gets a house foreclosed on, sometimes the family will end up living there as if they're squatters. And if the, and in one particular case, the neighbors could afford to string their electricity lines over to this other house to give them electricity until they got themselves off their feet again. So those are the kind of things that you just kind of like empirically witness as you're walking around. It beats the people up. But we've actually been having a lot of success in talking to people about the solutions and getting a lot of people involved. I mean, that's basically what I could say for now.
Oh, that's sure. We're living in a different kind of ground zero. Our studio right here in Loudoun County, which was the high end, and as a percentage of all mortgages given out in the recent 20 years, the percentage is very low of mortgages in trouble. But there, the signs have shown up just in the last few weeks and months of either for auction, for foreclosure, and so forth. And so, Richard, then, what about the general, what are the general dimensions of this? I have to tell everyone, he just made a list in the last 24 hours, and it had 38 on when he finished of, what is that, lending agencies for home mortgages that have gone under or are in trouble just in the last many months?
Yeah, since about the midpoint of last year, sort of picking up on something both you said, Marcia, and Lewis, about the situation in Detroit, because, look, the question is the subprime mortgages, which are about $1.2 trillion of mortgages, and I'll describe what they are. But what they have done is they caused a 242-point drop in the Dow Jones, people may know, on March 13th. They obliterated this disintegration, the New Century Financial, which was the second largest subprime mortgage lender. They're just gone. They threatened the $600 trillion world derivatives market. They're causing tens of billions of dollars of losses on hedge and mutual funds. And they're spreading contagion, not just from subprimes, but to what they call Alt-A, which are above subprime but below prime, and into the prime mortgage market, which is $10 trillion, which is one quarter of all the outstanding credit in the United States. Now, if you put that together with the yen carry trade, which I know Paul Gallagher has covered in recent shows, then you've got...
This disintegration of this other practice in the last few years of you borrow low in Japan or somewhere, and then you go speculate, and then you pay it back low. But on the other hand, it's not continuing.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, this idea that you borrow yen at very low rates, probably less than 1%, because you pay a little bit more than what the central bank lends for, and then you invest it, say, for example, in Turkey, where now you can get over a 20% rate of return for investing it in a Turkish lira instrument. That's the name of the currency there. So that has been a major problem. You put these two together, the collapse of the subprime and the unwinding or ending of the yen carry trade, and you've got the world, you know, accelerating into systemic breakdown. Now, I do want to say one thing about this with regard to Lynn. This is the Lyndon LaRouche show, but there's a special reason for it also. Until recently, nobody would account for a systemic risk of the subprimes. I mean, there were one or two gentlemen or something, or gentlewomen, but 3 months ago, there was no one talking about it except Lynn, and no one talking about it from the point that it could develop into a systemic world development. And the importance of this is that what LaRouche has said is, look, despite every disclaimer, he released a statement March 14th. Despite every disclaimer you hear, the world, the entire financial system is coming down. And he said, the thing that I need is support from the Congress and the administration. And if I get that, I know what to do. I can't save everything, but I can control the situation and put the whole system into bankruptcy. If not, then the members of Congress, and especially those who are running for president and decided that that's their primary activity rather than the future of the United States, they are going to be the most hated individuals on the face of the earth. So I think that's a rather dramatic way to put what he sees as the, you know, intersection of this and the importance.
Well, we have a lot of questions here, but let me ask one more to you,
sure.
Rich, because there's all kinds of you just gave these huge dimensions of it, and of course it's all happening. And and some of the biggies, I understand, are jumping ship. That's no metric as far as the real economy for people's real living conditions. But I understand a George Soros, famous buddy from years past, who
Rogers.
Is a speculative shark, is now talking about this. Is that right?
Yes, Jim Rogers is saying this and a few others. I mean, I think what's happened in the last 3 weeks is that it's reached the point of being so evident that unless you want to be a Pollyanna to the nth degree, you have to say something about what's happening, because you have many markets that are freezing up. And just to address this question, just so people know what we're talking about, the thing to look at, and we'll have a timeline in this article as part of the package, is that you really have a decision when the IT technology bubble, so-called, burst in March of 2000. Greenspan, who was Federal Reserve Board chairman, decided in 2001 that he was going to create a housing bubble. And he cut the federal funds rate, which is the rate that banks trade money overnight, but the Federal Reserve controls it, 13 times, so that by August of 2003, starting January 2001, he had lowered the prime rate down to the overnight federal funds rate to 1%. And that brought the rates down on the borrowings of what you could pay for a mortgage. And this was deliberate. Now, they have gone through, meaning Greenspan, he's no longer there, but his policy is, and the banks. They went and did multiple sweeps through the middle and upper income levels. They swept through them 4, 5, 6 times. You know, people refinanced their mortgage many times. They've refinanced their second house. So what they did is they said, okay, we're going to take a predatory lending thing, which is incriminal and really should not exist, just like hedge funds. And we're going to get the lower 30%, and we're going to rake off, suck out from them what we haven't, you know, because we can't keep going back to the same sectors as a diminishing return. So we'll get the subprime, and we'll also get these exotic mortgages, and we'll sweep through them again.
Meaning all these unconventional, you know, deal. Here, have we got a deal for you?
Have we got a deal for
okay.
you? Okay. And what it is it targets, you know, poor African American and Hispanics, poor whites, and anyone who's got a terrible credit rating. And what it does is, just to give a conclusion, the charges that you get on a subprime loan, if you add everything up, the interest rates, the fees, the penalties, are 25% to 100% higher than on a normal loan. But these are people who could not even pay probably the normal mortgage. So you're basically running a deliberate loan shark operation, knowing in advance that they're not going to be able to pay this amount, because they can't even meet the previous, they couldn't even meet a normal loan, and this is so much more expensive. And it's really, in my view, organized crime. But what has happened, Marcia, is that in the last few years, all the big banks and investment banks have said, hey, this is what we want to do, so we'll get the loan sharks to work for us. Just to give an example, HSBC, the
famous Hong Kong
Shanghai Bank, the Crown's dope incorporated bank, they bought Household International in 2003 for $15.5 billion, and they're one of the three largest subprime lenders. Merrill Lynch bought something called Saxon last year in September, and so forth. Morgan Stanley bought a company. So that the subprimes are working, many of them, for these banks to steal from people. So
they do the dirty work. And the banks have the own them. And
The banks own them, and the banks are quite happy to run people through the mill on this sort of thing. And, you know, the poor individual who gets these things thinks, well, at least I'll get a house. But this is Las Vegas. This is in Las Vegas, as people know, the house always wins. And these things are arranged in exactly that fashion. And so we can then talk about how the reality impinged on it and why really on the foreclosure rates you were mentioning before, why the stuff started to unravel actually last fall. And anyone who was paying attention would have known that, but most people, of course, were not paying attention.
And this was one aspect of what LaRouche said earlier last year, that around the end, third, fourth quarter, there were different features of the economy, and this being one of them, that would become, so to speak, unsustainable. You can't continue this.
Absolutely. And the physical, there's always a physical parameter to approach this, you know, from LaRouche's perspective, and there's a real physical parameter. In an era of globalization, when you start with a low income and then you get the slashed further and you lose your job or someone in your family loses your job, you cannot service these usurious, swelling monthly mortgage payments. And so what started happening, which if anybody was honest, and I include in this bankers and regulators, neither of whom are in this respect, last fall, it was very clear. I'll give you an example. Sacramento. Before you get to foreclosure, which is where after 90 days of not paying, the bank initiates basically taking away your home.
So you have delinquency, non-payment for a while, you
correct.
Mean? Correct. Okay.
And the there's two types of delinquency, but the one people look at is 60 days. So just give you a situation. Sacramento, a fairly large city, one of the 20 largest cities in America. In 2005, their delinquency rate was a modest 3.4%.
Is that of all mortgages?
Of all subprime mortgages.
Good.
Subprime mortgages.
Okay.
In 2006, it was 14.1%. And so you can look at it two ways. It went up 10.7 percentage points or it went up four times. Now, if you're a banker, you're not waiting till the figures are published by the Mortgage Bankers Association last year. You have a real-time way of knowing this. If someone's not paid you for 2 months, you know it. So these – and I could go through – there's a whole list we'll put out in the EIR of city after city where this was like it. So if you see the delinquency rising, you know that foreclosures can't be far behind. And just to amplify the point that Lewis made, he may want to make some more, but the according to the Mortgage Bankers Association, while the average foreclosure – now that's 90 days you haven't paid and now the bank is moving to take it away from you. While the national average is 4.5%, in three states, Indiana, it's 9.3%, Michigan, 9.5%, and Ohio, 11%. And no one who's in our Detroit office will have to guess what those states are because they organize those states. That's the once industrial center of the United States. So that's another tip-off that had actually gone even further than just default delinquencies.
Right. Well, let me ask Lewis, and either Lewis or Richard, you have what you described, plus you have other things people listening to this show or at large, some of them know about. You've had raids, mergers and acquisitions, these things called hedge funds or private equity funds buying up. So you've had all kinds of things. You have the shutdown of our auto sector, the most dramatic wave of industrial crisis. So is there – what's the situation in Congress in responding to this? Richard, you said March 14th, LaRouche put out that you better listen. This is reality, buddy. Is something happened or not? This is a loaded question I want to supplement in just a minute. But first, Richard, do you know of anything happening or not?
Okay, well, I can just say this. As far as we can tell, absolutely nothing.
That's what I – that
absolutely
was the loaded
nothing.
Part.
I mean, LaRouche put out – as you know, Marcia, in April of 2005, a call to save the most advanced machine tool capacity, which is in our auto industry. And it has not been done. And the stuff that's done on this stuff is absolutely pathetic. I mean, Congress has just decided, well, they've done nothing. And I think the question is not just that they've done nothing. They have no conception of what LaRouche's call really means. I mean, there's even some people who are pro-industry, so they'll say to us, yeah, that's right. But if they knew that the future of civilization, of the American economy, depended on that retooling, for every feature of our everything from maglev trains to water systems and so forth. And that we're losing this. It will be sold by Dove Bid, and you know, to a country across the seas.
Yeah, like the industrial eBay.
Yeah, the industrial eBay. And the workers will be dissipated. Then they could not have sat there for two whole years now. And LaRouche warned them on the debt question. In fact, when he made the statement March 14th, he referred the fact that they had told people this debt question was coming. We see the physical side. Now we're seeing additionally the financial side. So my answer would be just that.
Well, Louis, let me then put this to you this way, because I know some of what you've been up to out in Michigan. I just want to throw in here, I know what Congress is doing a great deal of. I'm just checking. Because Representative Dingell, of course, is a senior congressman and he's from Michigan. I was at his hearing on Thursday, personally, because he chairs the Energy and Commerce Committee. And he's having a series of hearings that goes under the title Global Warming and Perspectives on the auto industry or on utilities. That's going to be this Tuesday. On Thursday, it was on states and localities. So instead of on the financial and physical economic breakdown crisis we're looking at here, you're getting this global warming historic diversion. And in fact, Wednesday, March 21st, Representative Dingell from Michigan co-chairs, along with the House Science Committee, Al Gore himself. So back to you, Louis. Then you're out there in Michigan, right in the middle of this, and you must see all sides of it, right? Genuine desire for response as opposed to this stuff?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny about Dingell, and the guy is FDR's generation. I mean, come on. What's wrong with this guy?
Yeah, well.
That's one thing I think of. But it also shows with the type of, you know, silliness with these committees that he's holding on global warming that he actually has a certain kind of disconnect from the population of Detroit at the same time. I mean, that's what I could say about it, because up here, you know, being what the history is, being, you know, the history of productionism and industry and things of that nature, when you talk about global warming, a person walking down the street might be, you know, say something like, what, you don't believe it? Why don't you believe it? That's a little weird. And then you start giving them the paradoxes and going through some of the real science of it, and they say, well, actually, I don't really know anything about it. So it gives you a good opportunity to make fun of the question of popular opinion and unrigorousness in thinking and bringing up Kepler and things of that nature in the field. So really, and we also found this very shockingly in the state legislature of Michigan, at the same time in which it was a very high openness with one or two ideologues in the state house on the Democratic Party side, relative openness to want to discuss these kinds of questions and think through the crisis in Michigan as a whole. And so that's been very interesting. I mean, that's what I'd say about Dingell. But the thing about the Congress is that internationally with the youth movement, and I do mean internationally, we just have to make this thing happen. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we had decided to go into the State House again, like we had done before. We had did extensive work around the question of the retooling of the auto sector. So we were able to come in with some of these Democrats who had returned and just tell them, listen, you should have went with LaRouche on this question, because the solutions are right in front of your face in terms of what to do. And using the global warming flank as a means to show them the wrong-headed thinking of the Democratic Party in general and then kind of just the heart of the problem as a whole. And they are a little bit small-minded because they're stuck in the lower geometry of thinking about the budget of the state of Michigan, which is an absolute mess.
Yeah, the dimensions of that, if you want to throw in, illustrate what you guys have been talking about, right? You have a gap, sudden gap of what, $3.5 billion?
Something along those lines. Uh-huh. And so Granholm, our cheerleader governor, is running around the state asking the citizens, should we cut more services or should we raise taxes? I think we should raise taxes because blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. And trying to get different referendum. But all of it really, really misses the point. And well, I'll say this about it, because there's a lot of freshman Democrats and a lot of black elected official freshman Democrats from the city of Detroit at the same time. And we've been really, really targeting them to try to immediately recruit them into what we're doing. And at the end of one meeting, one of these new Democrats, who's only 33 years old, his top staff member is 29 years old, and this staff member had worked in another office that we were pretty friendly with, so he's very familiar with what we were doing. As we just kind of went through this in a very, very high-level philosophical way. We talked for about an hour, and this representative wanted to know how we each got involved with what we're doing. But he also said, okay, that's it. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to read everything that I can about Franklin Roosevelt. And then my buddy Mike, he popped in and said, nope, Franklin Roosevelt and Kepler. We've been talking about Kepler extensively. And he said, okay, Franklin Roosevelt and Johannes Kepler, I'm going to read everything I can. You guys come back here, give me a month, and we're going to sit down for an hour or more and talk about this. That was probably one of the strongest responses we had got from the lobbying campaigns. But we had about 13 meetings set up in another week.
That's great.
I did have some questions about this because there are a couple short-term things that they can do, one of which we've been talking to them about, and we preface this kind of, you know, short-term type of thing with the fact that what we got to realize is the budget crisis in Michigan exists within the context of a total collapse of the financial system of the world, that you can't think so smallly about this budget without realizing, hey, you need some federal intervention, FDR style, and you need to put some pressure on the Congress and the congressman from Michigan in order to do it. But I wanted to ask Richard about, because one of the things that we were talking about with him was the Tobin tax and the revival of something along those lines, a tax on securities. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that is, in a sense, because I'm not exactly clear.
Well, it's a transaction tax to be applied against financial transactions. New York State used to have one for the longest time on stock trading, and since the stock exchange was centered there, it generated mm-hmm. some revenues. And it's been proposed by others, and at one point we looked into this and proposed it, to tax derivatives transactions. I would just say this. This is something it would be good to ask Lynn about. My sense of what he's been thinking over the last year and a half is, and again, I don't want to be the authority on this because he will say obviously what he thinks. But my sense is that he's been less enthusiastic about it simply because at this point he thinks you have to really just address the whole question of a total financial reform. I mean, it's the same thing, for example, he's been saying on the hedge funds. It's the same thing he's been saying pretty much, definitely has been saying on the mortgage situation. He said the only way you can deal with it, you've got to take on the system, because what you're dealing with is an Anglo-Dutch system. And these guys are going to preserve their power. They're going to fight ferociously. They will go to World War III and a general war, not just against Iran, but against India, against China, against Russia, to preserve this system and the instruments they have. And when you're dealing with an enemy that's so determined on that level, you have to be willing to take him on, because otherwise you won't get anything of real fundamental. So, again, I think you can ask him about it, you know, whether it would be a revenue source or not that could be tapped. But my sense is that he's saying right now, look, we've got to do this. He just said on this March 14th statement, which people who may be listening don't know, we have a daily briefing. And he said there, the solution to the mortgage situation is I will do it. I will put the financial system through bankruptcy. That's the type of thing we have to do. And he's very convinced that this situation, we can say a little bit more about it as we go on, is so far advanced. It's not soluble. It's not that anyone could solve it. I'll just say something funny. The senator from Connecticut, Dodd, who could be called the senator from Greenwich maybe, where the hedge funds are, he said, well, why don't we put a few dollars into a fund to help people who have poor subprime mortgages, help them out. And he has no sense of what – he may be talking hundreds of billions, ultimately, as it spreads through everything, trillions of dollars. He just doesn't realize what he's talking about when he makes a proposal like that, just as an example.
At this stage, keep any questions, Lewis, but we usually make one or two program announcements. I'll just reiterate, you are listening to The LaRouche Show. We are weekly from 3 to 4 in the afternoon.
Okay, so this is – should I say something more about the rich joke? Okay. So anyway, that would be my – I don't know. That's what I would say about that. If you had a general system changed, you could then, you know, decide, and if you still had stocks and so forth trading, I think you could maybe decide to do that as a further discouragement, really, more than just, you know, just to tax it out of existence.
Yeah, the regulation of sorts, I guess.
Yeah, but you got to get the regulation, I think, into place. And I will only again say, again, to, you know, sort of introduce reality from what the enemy's doing, because the real reality is what we're doing, obviously, as you address the question about, you know, not taking it face value, but trying to organize all of these people, whatever their thinking stages are right now. But you've got Paulson, who's the Treasury Secretary, running around at various commissions trying to repeal even something which was not the strongest thing in the world. It's called Sarbanes-Oxley, which was passed in the wake of Enron. And the thing that these executives and businessmen and Paulson and a bunch of others, Chris Cox, who's the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, is otherwise a total nutcase, former congressman from California, real neocon nut. But the thing about it that's most operative about that is that what they say is that you should report, if you may issue an annual report or a quarterly report, the chairman and the president, CEO, have to be responsible, and they are liable on the law for financial things if this report is a lie. Now, that is so elementary, but the baby boomers they are and the thieves that they are, they want to repeal that part of it. So, again, you know, when keeping this in mind as the framework of what we have to address.
Mm-hmm. Sorry there. I'm just getting over the winter cold everybody has, and now we're on the air. Lewis, did you have anything, any other questions on the actual short term or the kind of thing people ask about in state legislatures is what they might turn to?
In terms of short-term and things? Well, the other idea was various forms of debt moratorium. And I'm not 100% clear on a lot of the different things, you know, we had discussed with Bob. But I think Richard's point is more to the point in terms of it really does have to kind of be a real top-down, highest-level kind of approach and taking this stuff head-on. Because otherwise you're just I think Jeff used a funny metaphor one time, giving the guy who's thirsty in the desert a glass of water as he's crawling on the ground, and saying, okay, you better? All right, good. And then, you know, taking off in the helicopter and not rescuing.
Right. And
it's
one,
really that type of thing. But
right. One thing about top-down when it comes to home mortgages and the FDR period, or I know farm foreclosures, they were just stayed. In other words, the kind of power to intervene exists under our republic and our constitutional system.
Yes, and let me just say on this foreclosure thing, look, we're just meeting, this is really the tip of the iceberg. Someone from Credit Insight said that 500,000 homes will be foreclosed on in the next immediate period. And then there was this economist, I'm just looking for his name, I believe his last name is Carson, said, well, no, it's actually going to be 1.5 million homes. Now, that means not just that they enter the stage of foreclosure. Last year there were 1.2 million foreclosures in the United States, but those you're entering some stage of foreclosure. These mean actual follow-through. Now, if you take about $250,000 a home times 1.5 million, you're talking about almost – you're talking somewhere about $350 to $400 billion right there. The point that I think what we're going to be looking at is this. With a $1.2 trillion subprime market, which is the size of it, it's about 12% of all mortgages, about $10 trillion in mortgages. And then another market, which is about $1.7 trillion of these exotic loans, which we'll describe in a second. And there's overlap. You probably have $2 trillion out of the $10 trillion loans that are in serious danger of going under. At that point, you can't think mathematically. You have to think in terms of process. You get something that large, or even $1 trillion, everything else is going to start to – credit's going to be called in. There's going to be credit squeezes. And people who didn't, quote, get a subprime loan but who are living in a $550,000 house in Loudoun County on an income that can only afford a $200,000 house, what are they going to do? You could get through that when you had this fake price appreciation going on for year after year after year, because if you couldn't meet your mortgage, you tried to sell the home for $25,000 or $50,000 less or more than you did before. Now the prices are falling. What the heck do you do? You can't sell it. You can't get it refinanced because a mortgage company that you owe $400,000 to when the house is only worth $350,000 appraised right now is not going to refinance it because you can't even cover your $400,000 mortgage. So you're stuck. And this is something that LaRouche called the bubble within the bubble. We're seeing it here in Loudoun County. We're seeing it with a tremendous vengeance. It used to be that you could put your – just a year and a half ago, you put your house on the market. It sold within 20 to 30 days. That's called the inventory time. Now it's up over 100 days. And this is happening across the country. We just don't even know how many people are in this situation. You can't count it because they don't show up in, quote, official statistics. So you have that side of it. Then you have what are called mortgage-backed securities, which are the strangest animals in the world. On top of $10.2 trillion in mortgages, groups like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are these big secondary mortgage institutions, as well as many of the private banks like Goldman Sachs and so forth, took mortgages that they bought from different originators, bundled them together, put them in a bundle of, say, $10 million or $100 million, put a guarantee on saying we, Fannie Mae, or we, Goldman Sachs, will pay the interest and principal in a timely fashion, and sold it to international investors or hedge funds, pension funds. People are invested in these things. There's an additional $6.3 trillion of these instruments, which are based on mortgages, but they're separate. They trade separately. They have their own interest rate. They have their own risk factor. So we're really not just looking at $10.2 trillion in mortgages. We're looking at $10.2 plus $6.3. That's $16.5 trillion in mortgages. Well, the stock market totally is worth about $18 trillion. So you've got a huge amount of money, which is one-third of all the credit in the United States. We have about $40 trillion of credit debt in the United States, and this is $16.3 trillion.
And the credit debt, you mean every credit card debt or credit loans card debt, or consumer or
consumer corporations wow. borrowing and so forth. So that here you get this thing. And then the last aspect, which really kicks this thing into high gear, is that they issue derivatives against the subprime mortgages, which are called credit swap derivatives. These derivatives are, quote, so-called insurance policies, which they're really not, but they charge a very high amount. And the market has become illiquid. Now, this is a big part of the credit derivatives market, which is $34 trillion. And the credit derivatives market is a big part of the global derivatives market. We don't know how large it is. John Holfeld and I go back and forth at $600 trillion, $700 trillion, a quadrillion. We just don't know. But if the derivative side of the market goes, then you're completely off to the races. So what you're looking at with this, the subprime situation is that it intersects the mortgage market proper. It intersects the mortgage-backed securities. It intersects derivatives. It intersects hedge funds and international investors who have invested in this. Therefore, you have a good chunk of the entire world financial system tied up in the outcome of what happens in this thing. That's why LaRouche is so concerned about it. It's not just a matter of people being able to pay for their house, which is an important question, and whether they get thrown out in the street, which is an important question. It's that everything in the world financial system is vectored off of this insane bubble, which should have never been allowed to be created, but it was created because Greenspan and the boys said, well, where else can we loot and steal from? Well, why don't we take the lower 30%? They're sitting there. We'll run around them. They'll give them things that they can never even understand what we hand before them. Before they know it, we've got their life signed over to us. That's what the danger is right now in this whole thing.
Yes, I noticed, speaking of understatement, yesterday's Financial Times, you know, comes out of London but published here in the United States and elsewhere. They had a whole page whose major headline said, quote, chain reaction is a dread, end quote, meaning covering on the subprime mortgage market of the United States. So in other words, you have whole chain reactions of non-payment. So, and Richard, you're not, someone can say, oh, well, it's okay, stocks went up today. But you're talking about playing out over weeks and months and behind the scenes.
Correct. Although you never know, as Lynn always says, you can't predict any date. That's an impossibility. You can forecast the conditions under which this occurs. And the thing that has really been interesting about the fact that this has gone from the back pages to what you're just quoting now, and you just see it on the front pages, it's everything. It's in, there's an article in the subprime mortgage market just about every week in Newsweek, Time magazines, and all the other Mickey Mouse, you know, type of publications for national consumption. It's on the front page of USA Today. The Wall Street Journal carries two or three a day. There is real knowledge. See, the problem they have, I'll just mention, is on this derivatives market, it's illiquid, meaning you can't trade anymore because no one wants to buy these so-called insurance policies, credit derivative swaps. Now, what happens when a market is illiquid? You try and liquefy it, but you just the problem is you've got certain strategic questions. You just can't come in and dump a bundle of money, although Bernanke, the current Fed chairman, may want to do so. So, and they're aware of this fact. And they're aware of the fact that this can spread to Britain, which has an incredible subprime mortgage market, and Spain has a real estate bubble. But it's not just sticking with the real estate question. So the fact that it's now suddenly gone from nowhere, or you know, the sports page to the front page, is a small backhanded acknowledgement, as you said at the beginning of the show, Marsh, on Jim Rogers, that they know this thing is far more serious than anything they're telling the American population.
Right. So in the reality is sensed in different ways, though, of course. So, Lewis, one thing I wanted to ask you, too, we have, I don't know if you've received a shipment yet, but LaRouche's last Washington, D.C.-based international webcast to rally and warn people and call them again to face reality, that's just been released by the LaRouche Political Action Committee, about 150,000 copies, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got it.
And so are you circulating that already, or it's just arrived?
It's pretty much just arrived, but we'll have some fun with it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I did have a couple questions for Richard, actually.
Yes.
One is it's kind of funny because we had just gotten in our briefing that – I think I forget the figures. I'm kind of bad with some of the figures, but General Motors, you know, of course, having its start here in Detroit, mm-hmm. and then you think of the auto mobilization of Franklin Roosevelt, mm-hmm. in which all of the men left the city, and all African Americans from the South and women from all over the city ended up getting employed in order to build this war machine. You know, transforming ourselves in helping Churchill out in the beginnings of the war before Pearl Harbor. And things of that nature into this huge agro-industrial giant that America had the potential to be. But now here's General Motors in a collapsing city that somehow has, through its subsidiary GMAC, mm-hmm. got involved in the subprime mortgage market.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, what that means in a for like a what should be the, like a hugely productive company that's making all of its money with some sort of financial instrument, some sort of financial arm. I'm wondering if you can go through a little bit of that.
Yeah, look, that's exactly the way you phrased it. I mean, look, this is General Motors. You know, used to not issue credit for someone to buy its cars, but then it decided it was going to do that. So to allow people who wanted to buy GM cars and to extend them a loan, they set up the General Motors Acceptance Corporation, or GMAC. And it operated that way for a long time. But they then found that they could start making, since they had a lot of dough circulating, because when you're running a factoring operation, which is basically what you're doing when you're financing people's cars, you have a certain amount of cash on hand. So they said, well, why don't we put it into real estate? And again, in the last 4 to 5 years, this, you know, well, they've got in this earlier. And I mean, again, this is criminal in Detroit when you're describing that. At two out of, you know, you go up a block and two, three, four, five houses are boarded up or have a pink slip on it, you know, or so forth. And then you're going in, you, General Motors, are making these subprime loans. But the thing, it's called residential capital, or ResCap. And ResCap is in deep trouble. And in fact, it's a funny thing. General Motors was selling, has sold part of GMAC to raise money to this Cerberus hedge fund, which is a real bunch of gangster pirates. I mean, just, you know, low life, you can imagine. And so Cerberus bought, I believe, 51% or 49%. I believe this is 51. No, 49. But anyway, the deal was tottering because now as one of the divisions of GMAC was this ResCap. So General Motors just put in a few weeks ago $1 billion to help bail out this ResCap. Imagine the $1 billion being used to retool some of those factories that would be kept open so that the people weren't being thrown out in the streets. Mm-hmm. That's a real example of just how stupid the management of General Motors and, you know, Rick Wagoner and William Clay Ford III. We tried to, when Ford said, let's retool, we tried to go with it and try and get him to at least raise the question so that the real question could be posed before Congress. But he is a green, I mean, he's got things up on the roof of their building and they're growing soy plants, and they paint with soy paint rather than regular paint. But the thing about it is, all that aside, these guys are so far off in realizing what needs to be done. And I think the thing you just pointed out right now is a perfect example of that.
Lewis, did you have another question?
Yeah, about history. In reference to what you said earlier, Marcia, I was wondering about the situation in the Depression concerning mortgages, if you could describe that, and concerning, you know, what the state of housing and just in general the overall economy, in terms of what, you know, the question basically being, what was that situation and what were the things that Franklin Roosevelt found that he was able to do, you know, come in and do to help alleviate that kind of suffering?
Well, it's interesting. Just to take it up, I mean, one out of every five mortgages in the entire United States, we didn't have as many mortgages back then.
These are the home mortgages.
Home mortgages, yeah. Sorry. Were in foreclosure, as were one out of every five farm mortgages, too. And what Roosevelt did is he did something on a national scale, which was very interesting. He used the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which he used for public works. He used it for the war mobilization. He used it as a sense of Hamiltonian dirigistic credit. And he set up something called the HOLC, Home Ownership, whatever L stands for, whatever C stands for, Loan Corporation, yeah. And what they did is the Reconstruction Finance Corporation created this new company, bought up all the stock, and the stock of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was in turn owned by the U.S. government. And against this stock, which I think was $500 million, the HOLC could issue up to $2 billion and then $3 billion of its own debt, which meant it floated bonds and got in cash. And what it did is, it starting in 1933-34, it would make federal loans to people to renegotiate their mortgage, but he did it from the top down. And I know that when the office of the HOLC opened up in Toledo, it was two people deep,
in line
outside the city.
Yeah.
I mean, they were just outside the city. So many people, and people were getting there at 5 a.m. People were giving them coffee and donuts because they were going to lose their homes, and they didn't know what to do. You know, I mean, the determination is this. The mission, the policies, no one's going to lose their home. Then you figure out what you have to do. But your first policy is, what do we have to do as human beings? No one will lose their home. Then you say, how do you finance it? And so I think the Roosevelt thing, Lewis, was a rather interesting way of doing it. I wouldn't say it's the only way you have to do it. If you have that in mind, you basically got to get some federal credit in there, and an agreement that you won't move against the people. And because the solution in this situation is clearly the economy. What is someone going to do with their mortgage if they're unemployed? Because the unemployment rate shooting up and globalization is destroying, like a mowing machine, every part of employment. Or what do you do if you're a farmer and you can't earn anything on the farm except if you want to do crazy stuff with biofuels, and you get 60% of your income in the city? The only way you can solve the mortgage question ultimately is you have to solve the employment and the productivity of your economy, because otherwise, the mortgage loans are not going to be worth anything anyway. And I assume with some of these right now, I would just say write them down. And any bank that turns around and says, well, we made a $600,000 loan, we say, well, look, I mean, you weren't acting as a banker. You were acting as a gambler. So we'll work out something that you get something back. We don't want the bank to go under, but you were completely irresponsible and basically disregarded everything of due diligence that any banker should have had to do in the first place. I mean, these guys are not bankers anymore. They're just, you know, they should be in Las Vegas.
Eat it.
Yeah.
And on this, you know, Lewis, you remind us, too, that there have been some other precedents since then. But the FDR experience, principle, and practice, of course, is completely timely for today, which is what Mr. LaRouche points to. But even there was a certain period, I think that this would be the beginning of the Clinton years in office, when Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy was in office, and there was a regional moratorium on foreclosures of farms in the Dakotas. Very soon, there was a cooked-up scandal, and Espy was put out of office. Hmm. So this is just one. There are innumerable cases of this in the last 30 years, because there has been such a prevention, such a defamation of the FDR period and what was done. But there's even on the books some recent precedent and for this kind of thing. This was in the case of there was a several-month moratorium on implementing any carrying through foreclosures of farms in the Dakotas. So, but Lewis, just to ask you, you're carrying out a whole organizing front in the Midwest, and there in Michigan, you mentioned you're going to, with the legislature in session, you're including that, but also you're still going on campuses to people, because many people listening are very interested in the youth response, especially on either the reality of this historic breakdown of the economy and also the degree of promotion of Al Gore, his movie, and all this kind of stuff. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, in some ways within the campus work here, it depends on where you go, because you have some community colleges and places that are that have been here for a while, like Wayne State University, where kids are very much grounded in reality, maybe a bit cynical, but they're grounded in reality in terms of, like, for example, in Macomb Community College, you run into, you know, just about every other kid that you run into and stop has a parent, father, or mother who works in the auto sector or got laid off or you know, something along those lines. In fact, one of our, I guess what we call first circle contacts is coming around here. Her father works over at the River Rouge plant, for example. So you're constantly running into this kind of thing in which they have, you know, just being growing up in Detroit even, you can kind of see a certain type of decline that has occurred. And it really has kind of demoralized even the baby boomer population of workers and demoralized UAW members and things of that nature. Coming at them with hope that there are means to actually fix this kind of crisis really does make a difference, I think, in the way that they think. Like I said, it depends on where you go, because we have another school up here, you know, which we know and love, University of Michigan, the stomping grounds of Markowitz, who we had recently done some intelligence, but it was also the stomping ground of the Unabomber, if you want to talk about the Green Movement.
Yeah.
He had his doctorate up there. But so up there with kids that aren't necessarily from Michigan but going to this so-called prestigious school, which has a lot of very, very wild history to it, the institution itself, you do get the kind of ideological, you know, reaction to global warming and things of that nature. But I'd say the reactions in the campuses in and around Detroit, however, are very, very kind of realistic based in terms of the global warming, wanting to actually discuss the real science and being humble enough, as people can be up here, to say, well, I did believe it, but really, I don't know. I've never done any work on it. And you get that kind of response a lot. I guess that's pretty much what I can say about that in particular.
And so when you mentioned before you have 13 meetings you're looking forward to, is that in that's in the state legislature?
Yeah, that's in Lansing, the state legislature.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. Have you met Markovitz yet? Have you had the chance to encounter him in a classroom or setting or some other fun setting?
Well, we've snooped around. We've done a little bit of intelligence with the guys in the war room and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But we haven't intervened on his classes yet. It's something that, if we can do it, what I personally would like to do, and I've been in discussions, is mass producing that intelligence and following around from classroom mm-hmm. to classroom. You know, when the class lets out, he's got the class the next time. Just put it on everyone at a desk with his face facing up, so his students sit down, look at the paper, look at him, start looking at the magazine. Right, do it in just about every class that he's in, and really make it a kind of a real political battle and a fight on that campus itself, because we do have a little bit more trouble, and some of us do have axioms about the school, but we do have a little bit more trouble organizing there than we do in other places. I think such a hot button issue as that, as well as the global warming, will be something that in which I think we could actually break the campus and make a real breakthrough in the organizing there.
Now, one thing that's being presented in Washington, D.C. by the international financial crowd that's behind such things as Alan Greenspan's bubbles, you know, what they call the synarchists, is that there's a groundswell of state actions, city actions to go ahead with global warming. In other words, to ignore the reality of the economic collapse. So the head of the OECD, what is that, Richard? Organization for Economic
Cooperation
and Development, a longstanding institution based in Paris. The head of their so-called sustainable development spoke here in Washington, D.C. And he said, oh, this is wonderful and he referred to Governor Schwarzenegger of California linking up with four other states to set up a new carbon trading global to reduce emissions. And the Northeast, there's a pact in the 10 Northeast states. But they said, and Congressman Dingell brought in some state officials, not from his own place, from New Jersey, Texas, and California, and a mayor from North Carolina. But do you find, when you talked about this University of Michigan campus, and you might get greenies and global warming ideology, is there anything on the ground in Lansing that's trying to entrap people into this particular kind of diversion of the global warming or not?
Within the level of the State House, you mean?
Yes.
I know of one representative who's a little crazy about it. I think I mentioned, you know, the interaction with her. Well, actually, no, I didn't. But, I mean, she's only one representative. Really, I find amongst the representatives, amongst the staff members, openness to the possibility that it would be a hoax.
Because also, when you said the groundedness about people who've been connected to industry in Detroit, you have people representing agriculture and other city industrial centers all around the state, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Grand Rapids and so forth. And it's hard for them to that have to give up all of that to go along with some fiction about global warming.
Yeah. Yeah, the one particular guy that I was talking about from Detroit, just it's funny because it's characteristic of the type of thinking that we might have from some of the newer Democrats. He had actually complained very loudly at some point in the course of the discussion about the behavior of John Conyers, not doing enough and not having the courage and the, you know, whatever you want to call it, to go for the question of impeachment like he keeps on saying that he does, you know, he wants to do. So there is an element of fight, at least in this guy and a lot of the other people that we see and that we've been talking to, that can, you know, so you come up with something like global warming a hoax, they're very thoughtful about it, you could say.
Well, I think, so so we have a situation that's shifting very fast. You know, from your part of the world in Ohio, Mr. Kucinich, of course, who speaks nationally and so forth, he did say he did say on the floor of the House of Representatives that it's time to consider impeachment just 3 days ago. So that the atmosphere you're describing of the economic breakdown reality may begin to have beneficial effects, right, and giving people some potential for courage and a spine. Do you want to have the last word, Lewis, on what you expect soon or any more about the LaRouche Youth Movement impact? We only have a few seconds.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking about Richard said about the policies of Franklin Roosevelt, and okay, nobody's going to lose their home. Now what are we going to do? Reminded me also of the Hill Burton thing. So nobody is not going to get treated. So now how are you going to pay for it after we've done it? And then you think about all these different policies in terms of, you know, you call it putting human beings first, but no, it's the question of what it means to be a human being. And this is the question of Kepler, unlocking the creativity of the people that we meet within this city and the young people that we're talking to in the campuses and universities, and giving people that are, you know, down in the dumps and really a kind of an underdog mentality within this city reasons to want to help and to save human beings. What is the potential in everybody that you meet? And we've recruited on this basis, really, you know, in terms of that. And I think that's the kind of shift and change within the thinking of the legislature that we're going to need here in the state level. And also just generally around the country.
Well, that's great. And I'm sorry we have to end. And I ask you again every week to listen later in the week to the LaRouche Show from 3 to 4 in the afternoon, Eastern Time in the United States on www.larouchepub.com. So this is ending the March 17th, 2007 show. And I thank you, Richard Freeman, and I thank you, Lewis Weldon, very much. And stay tuned for March 24th. Thank you all.